Our next guest, Joshua Kors, is a freelance reporter and author in The Nation magazine, the April edition of the article, How Specialist Town Lost His Benefits. Thanks for joining us today, and welcome to the program, Joshua Kors.
Good to be with you, Sean.
Joshua, you write that a specialist named John Town has spent the last few years fighting two battles, one against his body, the other against the United States Army, that began in 2004 in Ramadi, Iraq. Give us a bit more of the background of this story and how you got onto it.
Sure. Well, John Town, a specialist serving in Ramadi, was very near a rocket explosion. The explosion left him largely deaf, severely injured in other ways. His memory was shaken, had a lot of post-traumatic stress disorder symptoms like flashbacks, nightmares, confusion. And for his wounds, he was given the Purple Heart. But when it came time to discharge him, the Army decided not to discharge him for his injuries. They claimed that he wasn't injured after all and was actually victim of a pre-existing personality disorder, a psychological condition so severe that he never should have been able to serve in the first place. And that's a significant change in outlook, because dismissing him that way, they never had to pay him disability or medical benefits for the rest of his life.
What is that little bargain with the devil that's required in order for that nice little economic arrangement to work out, where the Pentagon or the Veterans Administration or the U.S. government doesn't have to pay these benefits?
Well, it's a sad twist on the system as it's set up, because anyone familiar with the way in which the Army screens and deploys its soldiers knows that the system as set up is actually perfect. Soldiers are screened twice before going to Iraq, once when they join the Army and once when they are deployed. And in both cases, John's screening found absolutely nothing, and he is by no means alone. That's really the significance of the story. It's that he's just one of 22,500 in the last 6 years across the entire armed forces who has been discharged with this personality disorder.
This kind of personality disorder, you say, it's called a 513 discharge, for, I assume, the 5-13 in the military code, personality disorder discharge. What sort of conditions, when you were investigating this, did you meet soldiers and speak with them? What was your impression of some of the soldiers who are dealing with this 513 personality disorder discharge?
Well, again, it's a condition so severe that they wouldn't be able to serve, and the absurdity of the way they're using it is really apparent with each of the soldiers I investigated in my 6 months of doing this reporting. In John's case, he had won a dozen medals before being wounded. And, you know, they considered his deafness a personality disorder. You look at other cases like Richard Dykstra. They considered the stomach hernia that he suffered in Iraq part of a personality disorder. Other times, you have cases like William Wooldridge, who was suffering schizophrenic type delusions. He had been driving a truck in Iraq when a young girl was pushed in front of his truck. He ran over and killed her, and later was haunted by her mangled ghost. For that, they described him as having a personality disorder before joining the Army, and again were able to prevent him from ever claiming disability or medical benefits. And John, there's one more aspect to that discharge. It forces the wounded soldiers to give back their signing bonus. That means on the day of their discharge, so many of these soldiers find out that they owe the Army several thousand dollars.
Have you taken a look at the legalese, the language in these contracts, and is it your impression that the soldiers understand them when they sign them?
No, it's all in the fine print. It's sort of like the fine print in your credit card statement. It's not something anyone who isn't an expert would really be familiar with, and in fact, that's exacerbated by what's happening in the hospital. Every one of the soldiers I spoke to over these 6 months said that they were directly lied to by their doctors at the Army hospitals. Apparently, these doctors are assuring the soldiers that if they go along with this 513 discharge, they'll get to keep their benefits, they'll get disability pay, and they will get treatment from the VA. It's only on their final hours on base that they find out none of those promises are true.
You point out that it's Regulation 635-200 in Chapter 5-13, entitled Separation Because of Personality Disorder. It's a, as you point out, a cash-strapped American military right now, unable to meet the reasonable demands for health care of returning veterans after they've already sort of served the Bush administration's purpose, but about to sit out the rest of their lives in either disability or perhaps never given the opportunity for the kind of therapy, training, or re-entry program into what we might call normal American society after dealing with combat trauma and stress. What's really the ability of the American record-breaking sized $400 billion a year, throw on another $100 billion supplemental appropriation this year, for example, as is being discussed right now in Congress and the Bush administration? What's really the ability of the Pentagon or the Veterans Administration, the United States budget? What's the ability to pay for these kinds of support for returning veterans?
Well, that's one aspect of it. I think if you got in a down and dirty conversation with the doctors at these hospitals, they would say, we just don't have the money to give treatment for all these wounded soldiers. And that's one of the motivations for purposely misdiagnosing these soldiers. 513 can be enacted in 5 days. They come to the hospital. Sometimes in William Woldridge's case, they saw him for 30 minutes before making this diagnosis. Out the door he goes, and that frees up space for the three or four soldiers who are waiting in the wings. They are strapped for space, for doctor's time, for supplies, and if they were to diagnose them correctly as having been wounded during service in Iraq, they'd have to go to a med board, and that takes about 6 months.
You write that you've been in touch with Russell Terry, who founded the Iraq War Veterans Organization, and over the course of the last year, that veterans' rights group apparently had gotten calls from soldiers who were discharged under Chapter 5-13. Apparently, most of them said that the military doctors pushed this personality disorder diagnosis and strained to prove those personality problems existed before their service in Iraq, never mind refusing to acknowledge evidence of post-traumatic stress disorder or PTSD that would tend to exacerbate any pre-existing healthy personality into some kind of stress and strain. Did you happen to get a look at any of these military doctors' diagnosis, any of the medical records, or were those restricted for privacy reasons?
Well, I think the answer is yes and yes. Yes, they're restricted, and yes, I was able to get a look at them. And the fine details in those records really just highlight the obviousness of these misdiagnoses. For example, in William Woldridge's case, his doctor writes that he has no pre-existing... that was Richard Dykstra, his doctor there. Colonel Anna Parati writes that he has no pre-existing history of psychological issues, but yet they diagnosed him and discharged him as having pre-existing psychological issues. So the medical reports themselves just fly in the face of these diagnoses. I mean, again, to return to John Towne, his medical records show that he was perfectly healthy. after you see the medical reports documenting his hearing loss. Now, you mentioned Russell Terry. I should make a note there as well. I encourage everybody in the audience who is going through this 513 crisis or who knows somebody who is to contact Russell Terry and the Iraq War Veterans Organization. He's been on the forefront of this for over a year now. The larger answer is that so many of the veterans organizations I contacted have been flooded with these cases. Everybody on the veterans rights front knows about this scandal. It's only the public that is just now being informed.
Who was it you spoke to? You mentioned Michael Forbus and a couple of other soldiers who are actually fellow soldiers in Specialist John Towns' field artillery unit. And what was they had to say about John Towns' character and abilities during his service?
Well, everybody who knows John Towns, who was there in his unit, and who is in his family, had seen him day to day before this Iraq war explosion that he suffered, recognized such a significant difference in his health, in his demeanor. Forbus, for one, was able to say he was one of the best in the unit, and that it was only afterwards that he was deaf, was disoriented, and was unable to serve at the level that he was prior to that explosion.
You point out also something about the diagnostic manual. That is this a manual that the Army doctors use as opposed to the standard DSM-4 manual that medical doctors use in the U.S.?
It's a mix. The Army has very set regulations to what can and cannot be diagnosed a personality disorder. And they also use, as part of those regulations, the DSM-4, the diagnostic manual that's standard for psychiatric diagnosis. That added yet another bizarre detail to John's case. In the DSM-4, it says that a personality disorder cannot be diagnosed after a head injury. And in his case, he was struck in the head by this rocket explosion. I think we need to look at the financial aspect of this as well. I looked at Harvard professor Linda Bilmes' study about just how much money the Army would be spending if it were properly diagnosing these soldiers. Over the course of the soldier's lifetime, they would be paying $8 billion in disability pay and $4.5 billion in medical care. And they can keep that cost by giving these soldiers this fake diagnosis.
And are those $8.5 billion level of figures included in what we typically see discussed as the so-called defense budget, the roughly $400 billion annual defense budget, or is that those separate, paid for separately under veterans administrations?
I haven't seen the budget itemized, but I imagine that it's not. I think that money is going to fight the war on the ground. Anybody who's been involved in the veterans' care, from Walter Reed on down, knows that so little of that funding is reaching the soldiers.
Tell us about another soldier, Chris Mosier.
Yeah, Mosier highlights another sour aspect to this story. When the soldiers are misdiagnosed, they don't get the right treatment. And when they don't get the right treatment, very difficult things can happen. In his case, he was coming in after his traumatic experience. He watched an explosion, watched many of his buddies in Iraq burn to death. He was there to pick up their arms and hands after that fire. He came back with delusions of the same type that William Woldridge was facing, and he went in. Dr. Wexler at Fort Carson, who also treated John Town, diagnosed him as having a personality disorder, and after a scant few days, he was discharged, returned to his family in Des Moines, Iowa, and shortly thereafter posted a note on the door saying that the Iraqis were after him there in Iowa. and he had to save the family, then shot himself.
I'm curious if you, in investigating and learning about soldiers like Chris Mosier and many others in the Iraq War, when a terminology like post-traumatic stress disorder is used in our time, and we think about terms like shell shock having been used in earlier wars, and there's been different terminology used from World War I into World War II and the Cold War and for Vietnam and now in the first Gulf War and second Gulf War, to what psychologically the experience of war does to people. There were, in your estimation, were there fewer resources during World War II, for example, for veterans who returned to the United States after serving in World War II, who may have experienced the same kind of thing, seeing their buddies, as Chris Mosier did, blown up in front of him on fire? He had to pick up the hands and arms of his buddies there. These things have happened in war in the past in different ways. Every war is different weapons, different situations. But I wonder if you get a sense for how things are the same now or a little bit different compared to, say, World War II.
Well, there's a dual answer to that. In one way, it's been getting worse year by year. Looking at the figures for just the past 6 years, in 2001, 805 were discharged with personality disorder in the Army. In 2003, it climbed to 980. In 2006, it climbed to 1,086. That's 5,600 over the past 6 years in the Army alone. But you talk about long-term history from Vietnam on, even World War II, right? Shell shock, there have been different names for this. I've been flooded with email from soldiers in the wake of publishing this article saying that they've been dealing with the same thing and getting the same response from the Army for years. In fact, I spoke with Frank Ochberg, a physician who was on the board that actually created the diagnosis post-traumatic stress disorder. He said that years ago it was actually worse because there was no post-traumatic stress disorder codified in the medical language, so either they misdiagnosed you as having personality disorder or nothing. There was no alternative. At least now, with post-traumatic stress disorder and an acknowledgement of traumatic brain injury, which seems to be what John had, there is an alternative, a chance for these soldiers to get the right diagnosis and treatment.
I'm afraid we've just about run out of time, but thank you so much for joining us today. And people can take a look at your article in the April edition of The Nation magazine. It's also online, entitled How Specialist Town Lost His Benefits. Joshua Kors, thank you so much for joining us today on Sounds of Dissent.
Good to be with you, John.
You can find Joshua Kors' work, including that article and other contributions he makes to The Nation, at The Nation's website, which is thenation.com. You are tuned to WZBC in Newton, 90.3 FM. My name is John Grebe. You can catch this program every Saturday from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. here on 90.3 FM throughout the greater Boston region and streaming on web links at wzbc.org.